You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, April 14th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, a Matt and Mike Monday, an M&M Monday, an MB Squared Monday, any way you like. On today's program, Stephen Kinzer, former New York Times journalist, Guardian columnist, on his book, The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and their secret world war.
Also joining us today from Think Progress, Ian Millhiser. We're going to be discussing, you might have heard about this if you went online this past weekend, it seems to have captivated the right-wing world, the Bundy Ranch saga. You'll know what that is after the interview.
You will know why militia men are descending on Nevada. Also in the program, the Senate torture report that led the CIA to apparently spy in the Senate Intelligence Committee has even more damning evidence on the failure of the torture program and lies the CIA told about it. Plus, Scotty B, going to do a check-in with him before we go on vacation. I'm actually going to be up his, well, not his way, because I'm not from Massachusetts, really. What the hell, dude? Also, Britt Hume, more racial insight from Fox News.
A Jesus statue upsets a number of rich people. And we also have a great story about a Tea Partier, a leader in the Tea Party activist community, who believes the new white supremacist is the gay supremacist, and they are much worse than those white supremacists.
And that's the type of story that, I mean, it's stupid and shocking and disgusting and kind of funny, but I think actually in light of yesterday's, we just want to mention the, you know, terrorist attack on the synagogue, on the Jewish Community Center in Kansas yesterday. Three people were killed. This guy was, I guess, a noted Klansman.
His name was Frazier Glenn Miller.
Frazier Glenn Miller.
He was part of the white supremacist community. He was a KKK leader. Really sad story about
it's a heartbreaking story, and it shows this, you know, these, I mean, you know, it is funny to joke obviously about something like a Tea Party person making that comparison, but it's just so sickening because we know that these things live on and endure. I mean, we know, you know, a couple of years ago it was a terrorist attack at the Sikh Gurdwara. You know, racism, anti-Semitism, hating people because they're gay, whatever it may be. David Pakman actually interviewed this guy.
We'll talk about this more.
Yeah, we'll talk about it more.
We just wanted to give you the update. They've arrested the guy, three people
he was
dead.
Saying Hail Hitler as he was arrested.
Yeah, just really disturbing
it's
stuff.
It's a truly grotesque, horrifying story, and obviously
we'll talk more about it in the later in the show.
And just to say, to the extent to which, you know, this stuff is just worth saying on the public record, obviously our thoughts, wishes go out to the community. Look, we're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with Stephen Kinzer to talk about The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and their secret world war. This is the Majority Report.
Them say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger, sent by the Savior, welcome the Rasta youths.
I and I start recruit soldiers for Selassie I army. Hey. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger. Welcome the savior, welcome the Rasta youths. You're not for axes who are the general issue in a warning. Draw people them a ball, said them tired of mediocre. Evil a go fall when we tread in Ethiopia. Believing from down, cause them life no easy boat. Even Bantan said it's not an easy road. Operation, occupy the motherland. Calling all soldiers to kind each other along. From creation, he writing a job plan, but chronics can't do it alone. So I'm recruiting soldiers coming from near and far, I choose. Executing Selassie I works and me lost a far right truth. And them say here comes trouble, here comes the danger. Sent by the savior, welcome the Rasta youths. I'm on a start recruit soldiers for Selassie I army. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger. Welcome the savior, welcome the Rasta youths. You're not for axes who are the general issue in a warning board. Waving the banner red, green and gold. It is such a honor for season four. Discovered on stones, on trees and scrolls. And even in the stories that Jesus told.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Brooks. This is the Majority Report, and joining us now is Stephen Kinzer. He is the author of The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. He's also a visiting fellow at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Stephen, how are you?
Very well. Good to be with you.
It's great to be talking with you. So, you know, the Dulles brothers certainly both played a very significant role in shaping U.S. Cold War foreign policy. One was a Secretary of State. One was a CIA director. Situate them. Who were they? Why do they matter? And what prompted the investigation of the kind of history of U.S. foreign policy you're looking at to kind of focus, to use them as a lens through which to look at these issues?
As you said, these two brothers held unique positions at the same time in American political history. So this was during the 1950s when Eisenhower was president. John Foster Dulles, the older brother, was Secretary of State, and his younger brother, Alan, was director of the CIA at the same time. So this was the only time in history that brothers controlled the overt and the covert sides of American foreign policy. During the 1950s, the Dulles brothers were hugely powerful. They could make and break governments, and they did.
Yes.
But now there's an interesting contradiction. It's one of the things that draws me to them. On the one hand, as I look through their history and their backgrounds, they're really extraordinary in the forces that they represent. On the other hand, they really do reflect a lot of things about America. So I think through the stories of the two of them, you realize that we have a lot of lessons to learn from the 1950s, but the contradiction is this. We've almost completely forgotten the Dulles brothers. When they were in power, there probably wasn't a literate human being on earth who didn't know the name Dulles. And now when I was working on this book, sometimes people, friends of mine would say to me, so what are you doing? What are you writing about these days? And I'd say, well, I'm writing about Dulles. And they'd say, the airport?
Right.
That's how far they've fallen out of the public consciousness. So my book, in a sense, is a way to tell the story of the 1950s through their experience and use the forces that shaped them as a way to talk about the forces that still shape the way the United States deals with the rest of the world.
Well, right, because that's such a great way of putting it, because unfortunately their legacy is certainly living on far beyond an airport being named, you know, Dulles. So there's a couple of key points here that you talk about with regard to the 50s, and I think one is, you know, getting to what were these kind of core forces that drove the brothers. And it seems to me from reading you that it was essentially a certain brand of missionary fundamentalist Christianity, corporate global capitalism, and a kind of fusion of missionary zeal and willingness to kind of play in the sort of margins or dark arts of global politics. That seems like one thing. And the other thing that you bring up that's really important is, in order to understand these brothers and understand the 50s, we have to step out of a frame where we think of the 50s as a time where obviously the world was incredibly tense and there was the Korean War and the Cold War was, you know, was hot. But it was a time of peace because there was no actual direct conflict, obviously, between the United States and Soviet Union. But the reality is that when we step back from that frame, governments are getting deposed all over the world. There's massive amounts of violence and conflict that was driven by this Cold War framework. So for most of the world, this was a very – it was a hot decade.
You're absolutely right, and that is indeed one of the themes of my book. I'm trying to point out that we've misunderstood the history of the 1950s. We do think of it, as you suggested, as a kind of a period of tense peace. But in fact, the Dulles brothers were leading the United States into an unrelenting world war all during that period. Now, we didn't see it. The United States public didn't see this war because it was fought largely clandestinely and through covert operations. In addition, the theater of operations in this war kept changing from Iran to Guatemala to Indonesia to Egypt to India to the Congo to Cuba to Vietnam. So it was difficult to keep an eye on it. And when it did crop up into public view as it did in places like Guatemala or Indonesia, Americans were told, this is just some kind of a local uprising. This is one way the two brothers work together. So Foster Dulles, the older brother who was Secretary of State, would start making speeches about Country X and why this country was falling under the rule of communists and it was a very dangerous threat to the United States. Then Allen Dulles would secretly go out and start fomenting upheaval and trouble in that country. And then Foster Dulles would make speeches saying how gratifying it was and indeed inevitable to see that the oppressed people in Country X were of their own accord rising up against their odious communist leaders. That's how the two brothers functioned as a kind of a, like, two jaws of a serpent that were working together, one visibly and one invisibly, to counteract these countries, which in many cases did not pose threats to the United States.
Absolutely. So let's actually kind of, I think there are two examples that you go, I mean, there's numerous examples, obviously, but two examples, well, and actually as a fascinating sidebar, when you talk about some of the earliest examples of going after leaders in Congo, Guatemala, Iran, Vietnam, and Cuba, and actually the only leaders that kind of survived this projection by the Dulles brothers were the two ones who actually were communists, which is a kind of funny historical irony. But, you know, let's go specifically to Iran and Guatemala in terms of what leaders were the Dulles brothers were deposing in those countries. And how do those legacies live on in very different ways and in different parts of the world, but connected, obviously, by a certain foreign policy, a certain outlook, and a certain type of intervention?
We talked about the forces that created the Dulles brothers, and certainly the belief in American exceptionalism was one, and missionary Calvinism was another. But the third would certainly be corporate power. Yeah. Both of the brothers spent decades working for this remarkable Wall Street law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. And that was a firm that had a specialty. The specialty of that firm was pressuring small countries to do what big American companies wanted them to do. That was what the Dulles brothers spent most of their working lives doing. So they were very used to this art of subjecting countries to what their clients wanted. Now, in the early 1950s, just as the Dulles brothers were coming into office when they were still working as lawyers at Sullivan and Cromwell, they suffered two very unaccustomed reverses that really affected their clients. One came in Iran when a nationalist movement resulted in serious damage to clients of Sullivan and Cromwell, in particular a big engineering conglomerate that Alan Dulles represented, and a big bank on whose board of directors Alan Dulles also sat. So the emergence of the nationalist leader in Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, caused great damage to the interests of Sullivan and Cromwell clients, specifically clients of Alan Dulles. Right at that same time, or shortly thereafter, something similar happened in Guatemala, where President Jacobo Arbenz imposed a land reform program that affected the interests of United Fruit, also very important old client of the Dulles brothers and Sullivan and Cromwell. So, although they couldn't do anything about that while they were still private lawyers, as soon as they came into power, they began plotting against Mossadegh in Iran. They had him deposed within a matter of months. Then they turned immediately to Arbenz in Guatemala, and he too was deposed the following year. So, although they did pick up other enemies during the time that they were in office as CIA director and secretary of state, their first two targets, Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz in Guatemala, were people against whom they had grudges dating back from the time when they were private lawyers and the nationalist movements led by those leaders had affected the interests of their legal and corporate clients.
So they really, they sort of closed old accounts, so to speak, in some of their kind of first actions in their roles in office. So kind of, as we'll move it forward shortly to look at how their legacies play on in the present context. But I guess the other part of your work about them that's fascinating is it does show that under Truman, there was certainly at least more of a debate about how the United States would relate to, as an example, even distinguishing between, a communist leader who, again, that's a separate debate about the threat levels of individual communist leaders, but that's obviously a kind of separate thing. Disaggregating that from nationalist leaders and nationalist movements, the Truman administration wasn't actually on board with what the British wanted to do in Iran. But under Eisenhower, it seemed like they had a pretty free rein, was my sense from reading you there, that Eisenhower had a big buy-in for the brothers. And then under Kennedy, he went ahead in the beginning because, of course, the Bay of Pigs was another Dulles production. He went along with that, and then obviously it blew up in his face. And then, through Johnson kind of eventually letting go of Alan Dulles. So how did they kind of just personally end up? Is that a kind of accurate chronology, or is there more to it than that?
One of the great misjudgments of the Dulles brothers was that they completely misunderstood the nature of third world nationalism. When they were in power in the 1950s, it was a period when many nations in Africa and Asia and Latin America were emerging from different forms of colonialism. Many of them were very poor and underdeveloped, and they produced a crop of leaders that were called neutralists as a group. They were people who wanted to devote themselves to developing their countries internally and didn't want to get involved in the Cold War. The Dulles brothers took these people as enemies and essentially did push away, I think, some leaders and some nations that were truly ready to embrace what we like to think of as American ideals. These were leaders like Nehru in India and Nasser in Egypt, Lumumba in the Congo. Then there was, of course, Arbenz in Guatemala and Mossadegh in Iran and Sukarno in Indonesia. These people were not communists, but the Dulles brothers saw them as enemies. So I think that also did help us intensify the Cold War. John Foster Dulles died while Eisenhower was still in office in 1959. He's the one after whom Dulles Airport was named. Alan Dulles was kept on by Kennedy, and as you pointed out, his first operation for Kennedy was the Bay of Pigs, which of course was a spectacular failure. And after that episode, Kennedy called him in to fire him, and he actually did it with a very nice line. He said, in a parliamentary system, I would now be resigning. But under the system we have, it is you who must go.
That's a great line. So moving it forward, and I'm, you know, what I think is also fascinating is that you can see the threads of both of these brothers, certainly, I mean, in some respects, in the Bush era, this belligerence, this global belligerence, the kind of fusion of a certain type of, maybe less overt, but I think there was definitely some types of Christian fundamentalism driving certain things. Certainly, a very deep commitment to the corporate interests. But in the Obama era, it seems like there has been, well, you know, I think it's still being defined, because I think you've seen Obama. I think he deserves enormous credit for what he's doing with Iran as an example. But then on the other hand, it seems like through drones and those types of programs that this administration has actually really embraced the covert legacy of the brothers.
I thought there were a couple of interesting moments last fall within a few weeks of each other. First of all, we had this moment when the President of the United States wanted to bomb another country, Syria, and Congress and the United States people, the American people, were against it, so it didn't happen. Well, I was quite taken by that, because I think it's the first time in my life I can remember a President of the United States wanting to take a military action against another country and not doing it because people were against it. Very soon after that, the President of the United States picked up the phone and called the President of Iran. That was something that would have horrified the Dulles brothers, who always believe you should never negotiate with your enemies. So I asked myself, did the Dulles era just end, just now? I'm not so sure. I think we have taken a couple of big punches in the face in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're a little bit groggy now. But I wonder, are we actually going to try to learn some lessons from the excesses of interventionism, or is it just temporary? And maybe as soon as we are given some smelling salts, we'll be back in the ring punching again, just like before. I agree with you. It's a little early to say. And the drone war is very troubling, because it does hark back to one of the great failures, I think, or great misjudgments of the Dulles brothers, and it was this. They had no concept of what we now call blowback. Right. It never occurred to them that their operations could cause huge negative consequences in the long-term future. And I think that's a danger into which we are falling right now.
Right. We're not thinking strategically. So there's obviously a moral dimension, but there's also just a dimension that fundamentally it's not a good way to secure Yemen, to kill a lot of innocent people in Yemen, even if obviously that's not the intention of the policy. But as a final question on this, though, do you think another theme that shows up is – and it's obviously it's a very different world and it's a very different context, but it seems to me that even again, we're having trouble distinguishing, you know, a group like Al-Qaeda, where sure, maybe there's, you know, people can kind of overinflate the threat level of it. But as a specific group, this is a threatening group, and they've obviously attacked us on September 11th, and there's a problem there. There's something to deal with. But then there's all of these other groups that might claim some type of Islamic identity in a specific conflict, and they may even, in fact, violate human rights and be really unpleasant, terrible actors. But they don't really actually pose a threat, a direct threat to U.S. national security. So again, are we also getting – again, in a different way, not a direct equivalency, but just that inability to look at the world and just distinguish, like, this is a threat, this isn't a threat. These groups are speaking in a similar way, but saying very different things. Just that kind of sensitivity to different context, basically. Are we still just missing that? Because that seemed to be one of the defining things about the brothers, that they just, it was so profoundly myopic with so many broad consequences.
I think we need to define vital interests very narrowly.
Yeah.
When you have vital interests in the world, and every country has them, those imply interests that you want to go to war for.
Right.
Since you're going to go to war for them, you should have as few of them as possible. You don't want to go out doing what the Dulles brothers effectively did, and what the United States did for much of the Cold War period, and indeed has done for much of the last 100 years, and that is to say, we have vital interests in every corner of the globe. This is very dangerous because of how serious that concept is, vital interests. So I would argue we should define our narrowly as possible what are our vital interests. One would be we must make sure that the United States is not attacked with weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
Another would be we must be sure that wars in other parts of the world or other countries are not do not spread to our country. Another one would be we need to protect sea lanes on which
right.
our economy depends.
Right.
After that, I think I start being a little bit more conservative. That's about enough. You don't want to have 100 vital interests. But I think there's something about America that pushes us to think we have vital interests everywhere. And when you convince yourself of that, then you feel you have to go and fight to defend them. And that has gotten us into a lot of trouble.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, the book is The Brothers, John Foster, Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, folks. So we are going to take a very brief break. We're going to turn on the Mission Impossible music. Actually, or no? Oh, you have a bumper music?
We can just play regular bumper music.
Well, we'll play some regular bumper music. And Matt will be right back with Ian Millhiser of Think Progress. He's going to explain to you all of this craziness that's taking place in Nevada right now. And it really is crazy. We'll be right back.
Your hands on your head on the tree.
We are back. This is the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder, and joining us now, Ian Millhiser, Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst at Center for American Progress Action Fund and Editor at Think Progress. Thank you so much, Ian, for joining us today. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. We cut you off there. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yeah.
Okay, good. Let's do this.
Great. So I wanted to have you on today, Ian, because we were just talking briefly right before we went live here on the air about this really what it was the story of the weekend, the what was going on Bundy Ranch. And I hadn't heard about this before this past weekend. And I was trying to find information about it, and everything seemed to be reports from like conspiracy outlets or clearly biased right-wing blogs and, you know, right-wing news, quote unquote. But you Think Progress, you particularly, obviously, being that you're on the program, you really covered this in a way that I was able to look at, take it in, and say, all right, now I really know what's going on. So the people who heard about Bundy Ranch and was maybe searching Twitter, searching Google to find out what was going on, and they were just getting some, you know, right wing news website or some conspiracy blog. Can you tell us what is going on at Bundy Ranch that has everybody talking?
Sure. So the Bundy Ranch, it's named after the owner, Cliven Bundy. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Bundy's been illegally grazing his cattle on federal land for 20 years. And the feds have been trying to stop him from doing this for 20 years. There's actually been three separate court orders. The earliest one was 1998, telling him to cut it out.
Uh-huh.
And finally, after two decades of this fight, last year they went to the court again, and they got another order saying that they can physically remove his cattle. So they can take his cows and impound them if he doesn't remove them from federal land. And last Saturday, a week ago Saturday, they started that roundup.
I just want to point out, this is public land, correct? This is not privately owned. This isn't Bundy owned land, because that seemed to be one of the discrepancies that I constantly saw right wing outlets saying it was his land. And literally, you were among one of the few who are actually giving me that this is not his land. This is public owned land, government owned land.
That's correct. This is federal government land. The feds own this land. And he's given a bunch of, you know, increasingly ridiculous reasons for why he thinks he should be allowed to do whatever he wants. He's claimed that, well, my family was here before the federal government was. He's claimed that the Constitution doesn't give the federal government power to regulate federal lands, which it absolutely does,
yes,
in very explicit terms. And then he's claimed, this is my favorite one, he just said, I don't recognize the United States government as even existing. So that's who we're talking about here. We're talking about someone who, like, refuses to admit to the legitimacy of the United States of America. And somehow, this guy became a bit of a media celebrity. He was on Sean Hannity. A lot of right-wing radio picked him up. Right-wing Twitter picked him up. And he became such a hero, that you started having, not just protesters, but armed militiamen make a pilgrimage out to Nevada, and some of them explicitly said they were going to provide armed support for Mr. Bundy and to help resist the federal officials that were rounding up his cows. Where this stands right now is that on Saturday, the federal government ended the roundup because they said it wasn't safe. They were afraid that there was going to be a shootout between federal rangers and these militiamen who were showing up. And I guess if that's how things are going to stand, the lesson is, if you want to go rob a bank or you want to go commit some other crime, just make sure you have 80 or so angry armed Tea Partiers backing you up, and then you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, I mean, From what you're saying, so let's just get to what I saw. One of the things I saw being passed around this past weekend was this video of a protester being, you know, tasered or a police dog being unleashed a little bit, so it lunged at a protester. And without a doubt,
no doubt about it. I think the government could have handled, the feds could have handled this a bit differently. I mean, no doubt about it. They should have saw what happened coming, especially when they saw all this media attention this guy was getting. But at the same time, saying that, you know, protesters obviously should be treated differently, and, you know, there was these First Amendment areas, which, of course, we all know from, you know, Occupy protests, we all think those are ridiculous. And no doubt about it, it could have been handled differently. But that, I think the important thing in that is to say that doesn't make this guy right, though.
Right.
And what...
Yeah, I mean,
you continue. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, there's definite clumsiness to, you know, certainly the way the PR was handled by the feds. You know, that video that's been going around showing the person being tased, it's worth noting that he was tased after he kicked a police dog.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's been handled clumsily, and that's because generally law enforcement, you know, they are trained to enforce the law, and courts are trained to issue court orders, and land managers are trained to manage land, mm-hmm. and they aren't necessarily trained to take on Sean Hannity.
Exactly.
So there's been some clumsy decisions by the federal government. But that said, you know, as a matter of law, this is not a difficult case. You know, this is a guy who says, I do not recognize the government of the United States. There are three different federal court orders saying that he has to comply with the law. I believe 8 or 9 federal judges have now said he has to comply with the law. This guy does not have a leg to stand on.
Exactly.
And ultimately the question here is whether or not if you get enough armed people, you're allowed to break whatever law you want. And if we're going to go down that road, we might as well give this guy the keys to Fort Sumner, because that's what he's asking for here.
I just wanted to point that out beforehand, because I'm sure there'll be some right-wingers or libertarians who come across this interview, and, you know, these are the same people who gleefully cheered on the treatment of Occupy protesters or when, you know, environmentalists get arrested, and then they turn to us when this happens, and they go, oh, you enjoy this type of thing when it happens to right-wingers? You know, it's... Yeah, I mean, it's just important to point that, I think. But so what I'm trying to figure out how to go at this here. What can be done with this now that the feds basically they've retreated here, and so this guy obviously is not going to get away with it. But what can I see? You have a post up at Think Progress from this morning, actually, where you looked at a few ways that the feds can tackle this now, being that they've already retreated. They know that this guy's got enough support where these right-wing armed militia groups will show up and back him up and create this dangerous situation. So what can be done?
I think right now the feds are waiting for folks to disperse. Their first priority is to de-escalate the situation where there's an imminent threat of violence. But once there's no longer an imminent threat, there's a number of laws that can be used to make sure that this guy spends a little time in jail. The simplest is he could just be found in contempt of court. He's been violating a court order, so a court can say, until you show compliance with our order, you're going to cool your heels in a prison cell. Barring that, if he or any of his supporters made direct threats against federal officials, a direct threat to assault them, a direct threat to kill them, that could potentially be a federal crime. There is a law, and it hasn't been used very much, but there is a law that forbids transporting a firearm for the purpose of creating a civil disturbance, or if you know that it could be used in furtherance of a civil disturbance. And so that law potentially could be used here, and the militiamen who traveled with their guns in order to back this guy up could get up to 5 years in prison. And I think it's important that some of these folks are arrested, because this is such a high-profile case. The principle that Mr. Bundy and a lot of his supporters are asserting is that federal law becomes optional if you got enough guns. And that's a really dangerous lesson for anyone to learn. You don't want anyone to think that the law is optional if you just have enough people packing heat behind you. And so I think that it's important, once the immediate crisis is over, that, you know, a lot of the folks involved in this spend some time in prison so that we can reestablish the fact that this is a nation of laws, and you don't get to ignore the law because you have a bunch of people packing heat on your side.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to get to the, because I'm thinking about it, and obviously I myself, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners here, are not quite familiar with how these ranchers work. So it's a regular practice where ranchers would let their cattle graze on public land, and they just pay a fee?
It's fairly common. Now, in this case, because of some issues that came up with the Endangered Species Act, I believe the feds limited grazing to 150 cattle per rancher.
Uh-huh.
So he did have a limit. Now, that said, in 1994, when he had the option to renew his permit that would have allowed him to graze those cattle, he chose not to do it. And that's when these events were set in motion, where he decided he wasn't going to renew the permit he needed in order to graze his cattle. There were court, and then he kept grazing them on federal land. That's when the court orders started, and that was the origin of all this. So he has not made the most minimal effort to comply with the law. And, you know, and there's a certain amount, you know, and a lot of people who've taken his side have said they don't agree with the policy that cows shouldn't be allowed on that land, and they don't agree with the reason why the cows aren't being allowed. And if that's your position, that's fine. You can lobby your congressman. You can mm-hmm. vote for someone who supports the policies that you want. But what you don't get to do in the United States of America is show up with a bunch of firearms. That's not how things work.
We know how these groups who are obviously using this to push forward their own agenda, how they see this issue. But do you know what people in the ranching community see this? I mean, I assume they all pay their fees. Do you know what they feel about this guy feeling he's above even them?
I couldn't speak for the rancher community as a whole. I think that most of them are fine, law-abiding people, and, you know, if there's land they need to pay a fee to graze, they recognize that it's not their property, it's someone else's property, and they respect that. I've actually been told that a lot of ranchers really like it if they're adjacent to federal land, because the grazing fees on federal land tend to be cheaper than what a private landowner would charge you. Now that said, there is a bit of a Wild West culture where you have, you know, these huge swaths of land where very few people live. There's very little federal presence or law enforcement presence of any kind. And what I think happened to some extent in this case, is this guy just had a sense that he could get away with things because he was out there on his own.
It's interesting you bring it up about the land issue in terms of, you know, the economics of it, because I think this just is another thing that plays into this with, you know, the idea that, you know, let the free market decide, get government out of these sort of things. I mean, this story just plays into so many of the different, you know, right-wing tropes that they constantly push forward. And I think that's why they're rallying behind this so hard.
Go ahead.
No, continue, please.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly plays into their narratives about property rights, about what they view as overreaching government. You know, they've got video of police drawing weapons, using them against these ranchers. And so, you know, if that's your narrative, this plays into it. But, you know, again, what this guy is asserting is he's asserting that the United States government is not a legitimate entity. He's asserting that, you know, the federal government doesn't have any power over anyone at all, and he's asserting that the proper, and, you know, and his supporters at least, many of them are asserting that the proper way to resist this entity that they view as illegitimate is through force. And that is a radical position. You know, I've been very disappointed that Fox News and, you know, a lot of conservative radio hosts and folks like that have picked this up, because well, I don't normally agree with what I see on Fox. I thought that, you know, Fox News and I agreed that the United States of America is a legitimate nation and has sovereign authority.
Well, also, this guy's a true moocher. I mean, you know how much they hate, you know, people feeding off the government for free without getting, you know, giving theirs. I mean, this guy's mooching off public land and not paying the fees that everyone else is paying. I mean, this should fall right into that, except for the fact that he's a, you know, a flag-waving, calling himself a patriot, old white guy. I mean, really. I mean, this is really what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, what this – oh, go ahead.
No, please.
Yeah, I mean, what this basically comes down to is that, you know, he wants to use land that's not his own. I mean, this is ultimately no different than if I came home one day and I found Clive and Bundy on my couch watching my TV and drinking my orange juice.
I would argue it's even worse because he's using this land not because he doesn't have a home, not because he wants to, you know, practice his First Amendment rights and speak out against something. He's using this land for profit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's very much true here that he's trying to profit off of public land. And he's trying to profit off something that he doesn't own. And, you know, at least as I understand what the federal government said, he's perfectly allowed to graze at least some of his cattle on that land, but he has to pay those grazing fees. You know, the figure that's been quoted in a lot of news reports, is that he has refused to pay about $1 million worth of grazing fees. So he owes the United States taxpayers $1 million for the trespass that he's been engaged in for these last 20 years.
My co-host Michael has a quick question.
Hey, Ian, I following this story and kind of thinking of like the other subtext for it is, you know, this kind of things like Waco and the Branch Davidians, like these are the other things that it kind of echoes. And I think I agree with you that obviously some people should go to jail and this needs to be handled well, but and not to be alarmist about it. But I mean, are you concerned that there is another scenario where things actually went in that really ugly direction, you know, where things could actually turn violent here? Or is this really more a show and a media spectacle with some terrible ideas attached to it that obviously need to be kind of shut down?
No, I mean, I think this is more than just a media spectacle. I mean, some of the folks who've been traveling out to Nevada have made explicit comparisons between this and Waco and Ruby Ridge and other incidents like that. So, I mean, you know, there is a message that purports to be from one of the lead militia orgs that's been sending people out there that ends with this line about how, like, most people just die when it's their time, but some people have the privilege of choosing to die in the line of service.
Jesus.
So there's a great deal of, like, you know, explicit calls for militaristic violence here. And that's, I think, why the feds decided that their first priority was to de-escalate the situation.
This is really like their fantasy come to life here. I mean, this is a type of moment these militia groups and right wing groups really they wait for. It's you know, you have this what they're pushing in the media. They want you to perceive it as you know, this old patriotic rancher who's just doing his work out in the West, and, you know, big tyrannical government comes to take everything he has. And the people need to stand up and use their Second Amendment rights. I mean, it's really everything they want in this one story, and it's amazing that they're taking it this far. And I guess we really should have saw it coming, but it's still pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that I would want to emphasize is that, like, the people who are going out there and doing this stuff to support the rancher, this is not very many people. We're talking about dozens, maybe hundreds of people.
Uh-huh.
You know, the folks in this country who believe that they have the right to take up arms and resist the federal government because they view it as illegitimate, that's not that many people.
Yeah.
What's been so shocking about this story is that you have an issue that is limited to a tiny number of very fringe individuals, and we've just sort of lived with these fringe people in our midst for our entire lives, And now you have folks like Sean Hannity, you have Dana Loesch, who's a fairly prominent right-wing commentator, you've got various radio shows, various people on Twitter, all these media figures promoting this cause that has always represented the rightmost fringe of the country. You know, the people that Rupert Murdoch would look at and go, wow, you're crazy. And that's a disturbing development. You know, we want our conservatives in this country to have some ability to discern between crazy and not crazy, and they fell down on the job here.
Ian, I want to thank you for really quick before we close up this interview. I forgot to bring this up earlier, but you had an update in your original story about what Clive when the situation was de-escalating and the feds had given him back his cattle and were moving out of the area. There was just this hilarious moment where whatever this guy's thinking. Geez, to give you a sense of where this guy's mind at, the rancher Clive and Bundy. As this is all going down and he's getting his way, he demands the sheriff to disarm all National Park Service employees and bring him their firearms. I mean, really,
yeah.
this is what we're dealing with here. It's stunning.
If it wasn't so dangerous, it would be hilarious.
Yeah, really. Ian Millhiser, editor for Think Progress and senior constitutional policy analyst at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Thank you so much for giving us the rundown on the Bundy Ranch situation. It was great talking with you.
I enjoyed it.
Take care.
Talk to you later.
That's amazing. I mean, that's actually stunning. Let's do the pitch.
Let's do the pitch. We'll talk about the interviews a bit more in the better half.
Yeah, we're gonna.
But to hear that, you obviously have to be a member, which you could do. You could become one by going to majority.fm and clicking on Become a Member and supporting the show for, what is it, like 30 cents a day, if even that?
I think less.
Less than 30 cents a day.
Maybe it's 30 cents a day. It's. We would always say less than a cup of coffee.
Less than a cup of coffee a day.
You can also support us by clicking on the Amazon link. Buy the Dulles Brothers book. It's in those morning's blog
there
posts.
There you go.
There you go.
And
I put the link through us for you.
So if you want to buy that book, you don't even have to click the Amazon link and search for the book. Just click on the link to the book.
Indeed. You can also support us by downloading the Majority Report app. That is Majority.
MajorityApp.com.
MajorityApp.com.
And if you're too lazy to click that Amazon link, you could just go to Majority Report Kickback.
Majority Report Kickback.
Subscribe to us on YouTube, youtube.com/SamCedar. We're over 30,000 subscribers on there. We're really trying to grow our YouTube channel. So if you're not already subscribed, go there and click subscribe. You get some great clips. Michael, we put up this from this past Friday. Michael has a great YouTube exclusive series that you do not hear on the Majority Report podcast or live show. He has a little show, you could call it.
Everything
You Need to Know in 3 minutes. And he runs down a topic every week. Really concise 3-minute summary of it and getting great reviews. It's part of the Majority Report, but it's a YouTube exclusive that's only at youtube.com/SamCedar.
And a lot more like that coming. So that's a great way to follow the show and follow everything we're doing even beyond the show.
At Majority FM on Twitter. Like us at Facebook, facebook.com/majorityreport. We will see you on the flip side. 646-257-3920 if you want to call into the show. And Majority Report Live, or just use your the Majority Report app to IM us. See you in, 2 minutes?
2 minutes. Maybe less.
Robert Paul is now first in...